Morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Chief Judge Susan Siegel presiding. This is case A-20-1324, Winter Rose Isaacson, formerly known as Winter Rose Anderson, versus Derek Morris Anderson.
All right. Now that we have that out of the way, as you both know, 15 minutes for each side with 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant. And Ms. Tabak, go ahead and just begin and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. Nicole J. Tabak, T-A-B-B-U-T, Pemberton Law, and I represent Ms. Winter R. Isaacson.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. I apologize when we said, will you begin? I was like, oh, maybe we're doing it differently.
No. I just had to grab my file. That's all. I was distracted for a moment. So, all right, go ahead now.
Good morning, Your Honors. And again, if it please the court, my name is Nicole Tabak. I represent the appellant in this matter, Ms. Winter R. Isaacson. We're here today because the issue in front of this court is whether Ms. Isaacson established a prima facie case for integration under Minnesota Statute 518.18, and whether the district court should have held an evidentiary hearing before ruling on the matter and essentially denying the issue. Regarding the standard of review in this matter, Your Honors, both parties briefed this issue, and we both agree that you would use a de novo standard of review to determine whether the district court properly analyzed the parties' affidavits. And we also agree that an abuse of discretion standard would be used to determine whether the district court properly determined whether Ms. Isaacson established a prima facie case for integration. And finally, you would use a de novo standard of review to determine whether the district court properly determined the need for an evidentiary hearing. Regarding the law on this, Your Honors, and this was briefed as well, Minnesota Statute 518.18d establishes that a prior custody order may be modified upon a showing of changed circumstances and that a modification is in the best interest of the child. Under 518.18d3, the court must retain a prior custody arrangement unless the moving party can establish that the child's been integrated into that family with consent of the other party.
And So I'm clear on the record, Ms. Isaacson didn't raise the issue of integration until oral argument before the district court. Is that correct? So the motion that was the written motion was to modify parenting time.
Correct, Your Honor. The first motion came from respondent. It was a contempt. We responded with a motion to modify parenting time, and respondent responded to that, stating that this was a de facto custody modification. At the oral argument is where we made the arguments regarding the custody modification argument.
And so your client's affidavit doesn't include any reference to integration, correct?
It does not say the word integration, but it's clear that the parties exercised an extrajudicial parenting time arrangement for 2.5 years. So they were supposed to start a week on, week off parenting time schedule in 2017. And up until the August 2020 order, that had not happened.
Well, that doesn't necessarily imply integration. I mean, integration is something, I mean, that's a delay in a transition from one set of parenting time schedules to another, right? I mean, that's not just simply by mentioning that this was the circumstance wouldn't trigger the court necessarily to think that this was about the legal term integration, correct?
Referring specifically to the affidavits, Your Honor, I believe that the affidavits establish an argument for integration. Absolutely.
I hear you saying that's your argument, but there's nothing in the affidavit itself that would lead the district court to believe that or to assume that this is a case of integration simply by virtue of a delay in the transition from one parenting time schedule to another. Doesn't necessarily trigger the idea of integration, which usually shows up in a different context, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think the context matters. And so when you look at the affidavits and it's clear that it's been 2.5 years that the parties have, this isn't just a delay. This is a situation where the parties agreed that respondent would have the children from Saturday to Sunday on one weekend and from Friday to Sunday on the next weekend. And that happening for 2.5 years, Ms. Isaacson also was very clear in her affidavits that because of that, and because of respondent's refusal to care for the children, to pick the children up when they're sick, to transport them to daycare, to ensure they get to school, these were all things that were in her affidavits. And so in the
how does her affidavit, though, allege integration where she is clear that the children are still residing part-time with father? And that was contemplated by the divorce decree. I mean, so there initially the children were up until a certain point to be with mother during the week and father on the weekends. And so what I'm having trouble understanding is how her allegation that continued and there was a delay in the 50-50 parenting time, how that evidences integration when that was contemplated by the original decree. It's not a situation where the children were just living with mother, except when she exercised self-help during COVID. And so clearly that isn't a consent situation. So the situation that you're pointing to is something that was contemplated by the divorce decree. So I the original court order in this, you know, dissolution. So I'm how does that constitute integration? And if you can address that.
Sure, Your Honor. Mother was only supposed to have the children up until the youngest child was 3, she would be the primary custodian and they would have that weekend schedule. In 2017, when the child turned 3, at that point, the parties were to begin a week on, week off parenting time schedule. And that's where, you know, we're taught, call it a delay, but the issue is at that point, the father said, I'm not going to take the kids to daycare. I'm not going to pay for daycare. Mother and father discussed the issue and they both agreed that a weekend parenting time schedule that they were exercising was in the best interest of the children. The integration comes in again, and the consent comes in that father said.
Permanently or for the time being?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Permanently or for the time being? Was there any indication in this agreement that father was saying, you know what, let's keep this going permanently as opposed to let's delay the transition. There's no need to do it right now.
I would argue, Your Honor, that it was Ms. Isaacson understanding that this would be a permanent issue because the children, the parties moved to different school districts and the bus did not come to respondents' home to pick the children up to take them to school. And respondents said, well, I'm not taking them to school. I work at 5 o'clock in the morning. And so I would argue that it was Ms. Isaacson's understanding that this would be a permanent transition.
Well, I wasn't asking you what her understanding was because, of course, her understanding, I'm sure, is informed by her position in the litigation. I'm asking whether there was any expression at the time that this was going to we're just never going to go to the 1 week on, 1 week off, or whether we just continue this for a period.
Your Honor, I guess for that question, I don't see anything in the record where the parties said this is temporary or this is permanent. And that goes to my argument.
I'm just going to tell you what troubles me about this whole case is the sense of, I mean, it happens from time to time where a parent will take the opportunity to grab and grab at time. And here you've got dad was obviously not disinterested in the children. Dad wanted to continue the relationship with the children even during COVID. And mom just decides on her own, you know what, I'm keeping the kids. You're not even going to have them. And dad's got to go to court to try to undo what seems to be a wrong by mom. And in the course of that, mom then takes the next step of the opportunity that, okay, well, we've got this agreement, let's make it permanent. And so, and then to throw in during the oral argument, an integration position and a motion to modify that wasn't there at all. I'll just tell you, that troubles me about the case. I would be most interested if there's something in the record to support the idea that dad had intended this to be sort of a permanent switch as opposed to just a continuation of what had been going on until some later time where the transition could occur to 1 week on and 1 week off.
Your Honor, and I would point to the record, I would point to the affidavits, and I would point to the exhibits, to those affidavits where, again, the parties moved out of the same school district. Dad very clearly said he was not going to take these kids to school. There's ample evidence between the parties messaging each other, and those are exhibits in the record to Ms. Isaacson's affidavit, where they are agreeing to, you know, switch days and adjust times, and these were all understandings between the parties that this was the parenting time schedule. I understand the court's concern regarding, you know,
well, it's a public policy concern. I mean, I think courts would rather not, district court judges would rather not get involved if it doesn't have, if the parties are working things out on their own. And, mm-hmm. and if the parties work something, if one party concedes parenting time to the other as an accommodation or just to make things work, it seems to be less likely that that sort of relationship would continue if there's this fear that the other is going to then go to the court and say, we've got to make it permanent and motion to modify. There's integration going on. That's my concern.
And I understand that concern, Your Honor. And I would agree with you to the extent that where the parties can talk about changing that parenting time and can work together to co-parent, I agree that we don't want to interfere with that and district courts don't really want to get involved there. But I think in this case, Your Honor, we've crossed a line. This isn't just, well, you know, the kids are pretty little and we're going to do this for the next year. We're talking 2.5 years of a parenting time schedule that...
Ms. Tabbitt, isn't there a difference between parenting time and custody? And what you're arguing is that there was a prima facie case made for a modification in custody.
Correct.
And so based on integration, so can you give me a definition of integration and how the allegations in the affidavit fit that definition?
Certainly, Your Honor. When we're looking at the definition of integration, the case law establishes that integration means that, you know, when you're talking about a child being integrated in the other party's home, that their daily care, custody, and routine is primarily with that other parent. And
what case are you relying on for primarily with that other parent? Because the two cases you cited, I don't think stand for the proposition that it's primarily with the other parent.
Your Honor, I would look at the Downey v. Zweiger case. I'd look at the Pfeiffer case. I'd look at the Giebe. I believe it's Giebe or Geibe, G-E-I-B-E. And that talks about when you're talking about integration, that talks about what is the amount of time that is being spent at the parent's house? Who is providing the care for these kids during this period of time that's being argued as integration? What are the kids doing at that home versus at the other home? So for example, who's signing kids up for activities? Who's making sure that the kids get to doctor and dentist appointment? Who is taking the kids to school? Who is overseeing the morning routine? Who is making and preparing meals?
Would you agree, though, that in both Downey and Pfeiffer, the parent that alleged integration did not have custody? In other words, those cases involved a parent who had sole custody and then the other parent was alleging integration. Here Yes. We have a situation where the court ordered joint custody, both physical and legal custody, and the kids continued to live in both places, albeit not 50-50, but there was still living with both families. So that's where I struggle to see that this case is analogous to Pfeiffer or Downey, where the child was living with the parent who didn't have custody. Here, both parents had custody. Can you point us to a case where a joint custody case where integration was found based on the children living more with one parent than the other parent?
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, no, I can't. I believe Downey and Pfeiffer were both the sole custody, as you mentioned. And I also believe Giebe and Wilson were that way as well. But the issue here is, you know, I don't know that integration has to be someone gets sole custody. I think when we're talking about a custody modification, it can be that we are moving from sole custody to joint, or, you know, switching sole custody or physical custody. Or
but
we can be moving
what you're
from joint custody.
Sole custody is, or your client seeking is sole custody.
And Your Honor, that's, I would say my client was seeking a parenting time modification. We came
but
here
then it,
from the court's order of, I'm sorry, Your Honor, yes?
But you appealed, you didn't appeal arguing the court addressed the wrong, decided the wrong motion. You appealed.
Correct. We appealed on the integration argument because that under the case law, that was, that seemed to fit what was happening best. And I would say that, yes, we would be seeking sole physical custody at this point based on the integration argument. I know my time is almost over, but I just wanted to point out to the court that...
Can I pause you for a minute?
This...
So...
Yes, absolutely.
The idea of integration is that, you know, this is the way it's been going on. There's sort of consent to it, but there was never any consent to sole custody. And that's where your argument sort of breaks down logically in my mind, that you're using a parenting time agreement to then jump to a motion to modify the status, the legal status of the children. And is there any case you have found at any time, published or unpublished in Minnesota, where that approach has been followed?
Your Honor, I would need to look at that very quickly. I want to say that it might be the case of Rose v. Lobeck, but I would want to be sure of that before I, and that would be a non-presidential or unpublished opinion.
So at least right now, you can't identify any precedential case that applies the integration doctrine in the way that you're asking us to apply it.
No, Your Honor. But again, I think when we're looking at a modification of custody based on integration, I think the statute is clear that if a child's been integrated into the moving party's home, that is a cause for custody modification. And the statute itself, by its plain language, doesn't say that you have to have sole custody. It doesn't say, well, one party has to have sole custody and then this is the only time an integration argument can be made. I think that even if you have a joint physical custody arrangement, an integration argument can be used to move that to sole physical custody based on the integration and the involvement of the parties. And again, that's why I would argue, Your Honor, that this should have gone to an evidentiary hearing on this.
Okay.
I see my time has lapsed. I don't know if you have questions.
Are there any other, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Any other questions at this point from the panel? Not seeing any. Ms. Moten, go ahead and just identify yourself.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jessica Moen, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Derek Anderson. May it please the court just to address some of the issues that are being discussed regarding the integration issue and a question regarding whether or not there was any indication that was meant to be, that the parenting time schedule that the parties had been exercising was meant to be permanent or temporary. I think upon reading the affidavits, there's evidence to suggest that it was never meant to be a permanent.
Ms. Moen, let me stop you there, though. In evaluating whether a prima facie case has been established, we look primarily at mother's affidavit. Would you agree with that? And father's affidavit is only for clarifying. In other words, the district court is to accept the allegations in the affidavit as true.
I do agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. I just want to make sure that in making that argument, you're viewing those affidavits in that manner.
Yes. And the reason why I say the affidavits support that was never supposed to be a permanent arrangement is that Ms. Isaacson wrote her affidavits. She does, allege that it was my client who addressed this issue with her repeatedly only when he was angry. But she also states in her affidavit that she would discuss the possibility of moving to the every other week schedule with him as well. So it wasn't an issue that was just raised by my client. It was an issue that was raised by both parties. Apparently throughout the entire time that they were exercising just the weekend parenting time schedule.
So what paragraph are you referring to?
That would be paragraph 7 of Ms. Isaacson's affidavit dated May 1st of 2020. She states when I, and so I do think that it was only ever meant to be a temporary arrangement, given the fact that the parties, that the discussion kept coming up between the parties. So I don't think that the that parenting time schedule was supposed to be permanent, even if when we take the allegations in Ms. Isaacson's affidavit as true. In addition to the issues with the integration argument that your honors have already identified, I do believe there are issues with the prima facie case before we can even get to an integration basis for modification of custody. The statute requires that there, that Ms. Isaacson established that there has been a material change in circumstances and that the modification is in the best interest of the children before the integration theory can even be discussed. And I think in this case, she's failed to satisfy both of those requirements. Now,
why isn't the failure to comply with the requirement for 50-50 parenting time a change in circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I don't, I mean, it certainly could be a change in circumstances. And there may be case law out there that suggests that it is. But when it comes to deciding whether or not there's been a change in circumstances, it's up to the district court to decide on a case-by-case basis whether there has been a change in circumstances. And the change must be significant. And I don't think that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court, who has broad discretion in determining those issues, to decide that, you know, there hadn't been a change in circumstances and that it was not in the best interest for the modification that the appellant was seeking.
So this case is a little challenging in that the district court's order addresses endangerment and not integration. And so when you say the district court found that there was no change in circumstance, what are you relying on? What paragraph of the district court's order? Or no change in circumstances was alleged by the affidavit?
Well, Your Honor, there is, the order doesn't, in the order, the district court does not specifically state that there has been no material change in circumstances. It's silent on that issue. But in Nice v. Peterson, the Supreme Court said that the court doesn't need to make particularized findings indicating consideration of the statutory factors. And so I don't think it's necessary for the court to state that there hasn't been a change in circumstance, but if there had been a change in circumstance, the district court has noted the standard in its order that it, there needs to be a change in circumstance and it needs to be in the best interest. And so that issue should have been directly addressed if the district court affirmatively found there had been a change in circumstances. And
do we even need to get there? I mean, shouldn't we really be focused on whether the affidavit is sufficient to allege a prima facie case of integration?
Well, and the change in circumstance is part of that prima facie case, Your Honor. And as I pointed out in my brief, that argument was never made. I mean, you know, there was no change in circumstances given by the appellant in any of her affidavits. She was merely arguing that it was a modification of parenting time. And so she briefly addressed some of, you know, the best interest factors, not specifically, but just in general statements within her affidavit, and bypassed any kind of change of circumstance argument whatsoever, along with the integration argument, as runners have already pointed out.
But because, you know, this posture, we have to accept appellant's affidavits as all being true. So we've got 2.5 years of dad shirking kind of week on, week off responsibility. So why is that not a change of circumstances? I mean, I'm not following that part of your argument.
Well, I guess, and perhaps I wasn't clear in my first.
And I know, discussion. And I know that's all contested, but we have to assume that he's, for 2.5 years, dad said, I'm not taking these kids to school. Forget it. I can't. I've got my job starting at 5 a.m. So I mean, that's 2.5 years of shirking, you know, your week on responsibilities. So that does seem to be at this stage of the proceedings where we have to assume everything mom said in her affidavit is true, a change.
And yes, Your Honor, I mean, we can assume that that is a change of circumstances, but as I pointed out previously, it's an abuse of discretion standard, and the district court has a lot of discretion in determining what does constitute a material change in circumstances on a case-by-case basis. So, I mean, considering all of the facts in the mom's affidavit is true, even in that case, I don't think we can say that there's been, you know, clear error, that the district court committed clear error. Even if there has been a change in circumstances, I mean, it's clear that the best interest factor standard hasn't been met either.
Ms. Moen, I want to take you back to the question of integration. Assuming father not taking the children 50% of the time is a change of circumstance, does mother's affidavit allege integration sufficient to establish a prima facie case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, based on the issues that I've already described, that it based on the affidavits, it doesn't appear that it was ever meant to be a permanent arrangement. It seems like an arrangement that was, you know, made agreeably between the parties based on her affidavits for the convenience of both of the parties. And it was only after my client brought a motion to hold her in contempt that she even made a motion to make that a permanent arrangement. So I think it was in response to my client's affidavit. It was never meant to be a permanent arrangement. So I don't think that integration has been established.
Does it, in terms of evaluating that, does it matter that her affidavit recognizes that the children are living part-time with father and part-time with mother, albeit not the 50-50 where they were supposed to be at this point?
That it recognizes that father was still having parenting time? Yes, I do think.
Or that the, not just parenting time, but the children are living with him on the weekends.
Do I think that that's relevant to the integration argument itself?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, yes, I do think it's relevant. It's not a case where she is, you know, the sole custodian of these kids. He's still exercising parenting time with them, you know, on a similar basis as to what the judgment had ordered for the first 2 years after entry. So the fact that he's, you know, he's still involved in the kid's life, he still clearly wants to be involved in the kid's life. And so he's still exercising, you know, his parenting time consistently every, you know, on the weekend, on every single weekend. And so I think he's still contributing a large part to, you know, the care and upbringing of children. He isn't just handing over care and custody to mom to solely take care of the kids. He's still actively involved. And he's pursuing his parenting time. They're working together to, you know, arrange alternative parenting time arrangements if the schedule doesn't work out. So, I think his consistent and persistent parenting time with the kids also goes to the integration argument, because he is still, you know, a primary caretaker, maybe only on weekends, but he's still absolutely contributing to the care of the kids. In addition, you know, to the fact that it was a frequent discussion that, you know, of moving on to the every other week parenting time schedule. So I think all of those factors are relevant to an integration argument. And as I was saying previously, I don't think the best interest standard has been met for the prima facie case either. That is specifically addressed in the district court's order. The district court found that the every other week parenting time schedule was in the children's best interest so that they could maintain a full relationship with both of the parties. And even taking the appellant's allegations in her affidavits is true, and only looking to my client's allegations in his affidavit to provide context, I don't think there has been any kind of an abuse of discretion in determining that the best interest standards don't support what the appellant was requesting for parenting time. the best interest factors, as I said, are briefly and just broadly, you know, addressed by the appellant in her affidavit. She just says that the current parenting time schedule works best because she's a stay-at-home mother, that it's easier for the parties because there's no daycare or transportation required, things like that. There's no specific analysis of the best interest factors, which there doesn't, you know, have to be. She doesn't have to point to each factor separately and state her facts in support of that. But there are very limited references about the best interests of the kids. A lot of her affidavits focus around the COVID situation and how the kids are in danger in my client's home, while my client, you know, addressed specifically the best interest factors. So I think looking at the affidavits and considering them appropriately, it was not an abuse of discretion by the district court to find that the every other week parenting time schedule was what was in the children's best interest so that they could maintain a relationship with each of the parents. And so even if for argument's sake, the not following that 50-50 schedule is a change in circumstances, the best interest factors still haven't been satisfied to establish a prima facie case to even get to the integration argument. And so I think the appellant has failed in multiple respects in establishing that prima facie case. I don't think the district court had any kind of made it abused its discretion in deciding that an evidentiary hearing wasn't needed because the prima facie elements just weren't satisfied. And I know in the appellant's brief, she discusses that the district court, you know, misapplied the law by ruling on the endangerment standard rather than an integration argument. As we've already discussed, you know, the integration argument wasn't made in the appellant's filings, which is likely why the endangerment standard was what was applied by the court. I mean, the endangerment of the kids in my client's home was the primary focus of the appellant's affidavit. You know, regardless of the fact that the court didn't address the endangerment issue in Gibson v. Gibson, this court stated that although the trial court incorrectly analyzed appellant's claim of integration, it also concluded that the best interest of the child would be served by maintaining the original custodial placement with the respondent. And if that conclusion is sustainable, the court properly denied modification of the three-part analysis required by Minnesota Statute Section 518.18D. And I think that's similar to the case here. Appellant's brief focus was primarily on the integration argument, which is, of course, important, but I don't even think that we can get to the point where the integration argument is the key due to the fact that the prima facie case was never met in this case. So I think the reliance on the integration argument is misplaced. And I don't think that the district court abused its discretion in deciding a prima facie case hadn't been met. Because of that, I don't think the evidentiary hearing was necessary under the statute, and that was properly denied. And so for all of these reasons, my client respectfully requests that the district court's order be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moen. Ms. Tabak, go ahead. You have 5 minutes, so please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the changed circumstances very briefly. Respondent argues that the prima facie case wasn't met, and respondent argues that there are no changed circumstances here. But the issue is that changed circumstances are determined on a case-by-case basis. And the last judicially approved environment was that created by the parties in the 2015 divorce decree. Since that time, the parties have not exercised the week-on, week-off parenting time for 2.5 years. That is a changed circumstance. Additionally, it is clear on the record.
Can I just ask you a quick question?
Yes.
So two elements of making out a prima facie case relate to the children. One is it in the kid's best interest for there to be modification? And then the benefits of the change outweigh its detriments with respect to the children. What do you rely on with respect to those two elements?
Certainly, Your Honor. With the best interest factors, we need to understand that parenting time is not an entitlement to either parent, that you just don't deserve parenting time, right? Parenting time is determined by what's in the best interest of the children. And the court in its order did not make, I think, adequate findings regarding the best interest factors. And so we need to consider that Ms. Isaacson has been the primary caregiver since these children's births until the August 2020 order. So from the time the children were born until September 7th, which is when the court ordered the week on, week off parenting time to begin, these children have lived with Ms. Isaacson primarily. And we can talk about, you know, dad having parenting time. There is nothing in the integration argument that requires a moving party to have 100% of the parenting time. Even in Downey v. Weigert, the child moved back and forth and integration was still found there. But getting back, I'm sorry, Your Honor, getting back to the best interest factors, Ms. Isaacson had been the children's primary caregiver. She makes all the meals. She does the morning routine. She gets the kids to school. She does all of those things. She makes all of the appointments, transports them to all of the appointments. When she asked for help with parenting time, when she asked respondent to pick the children up because they were sick at daycare, respondent's response to her was that she could figure it out. So even when respondent had the opportunity to parent, he chose not to and put the onus on Ms. Isaacson to figure it out herself. So that goes to respondent's ability to co-parent and his willingness to follow through with parenting time. Respondent likes to exercise weekend parenting time because it's fun. But when parenting time requires work, Ms. Isaacson's affidavits clearly point out that she was the one that had to do the work. Regarding the willingness of each party to provide ongoing care, again, that's always been left to Ms. Isaacson. Maintaining the party's weekend schedule, that provides continuity of care to the children. It doesn't upheave them from their situation. It allows them to continue the schedule that they are used to and comfortable with. And also, Your Honor, we have to look at respondents, his conduct. We can say that the parties discussed the week on, week off parenting time, but it's clear from the affidavits, or at least an inference can be, that when we're talking about discussing the week on, week off parenting time, it's in the context of respondent getting angry and Ms. Isaacson discussing with him at that time what is happening and how things have changed. And obviously nothing has changed because respondent never enforced his parenting time. He could have simply said, you know what, we're supposed to exchange these kids on Mondays, and I'm keeping Michaela and Xylee this Monday, and I'm keeping them for a week. He never did that. He had every opportunity to do it. He did not do it. Ms. Isaacson didn't kidnap these kids. She didn't take them against their will. There was no coercion of it on any part, no coercion alleged. Respondent allowed this to happen. And
Ms.
even
Tabbitt, the are you arguing that in absence of kidnapping and the other conduct that you just described, that that's sufficient to allege consent? I mean, here...
Yes, Your Honor, and that is in our case.
Is there any case that clearly says that where a parent requests to have their parenting time, as is alleged in this affidavit, that there's still consent even in that circumstance?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that consent can be implied by conduct. And when you ask for your parenting time and you're angry, and then you have a discussion about that, and then you walk that back and say, yeah, I guess this doesn't really work, that's the consent, Your Honor. But to your question about in the absence of fraud and coercion, I would just point you to the case of Gibson v. Gibson, 471 Northwest 2nd, 384. That talks about consent by conduct, and usually that you will have consent where there's been no kidnapping fraud. I see my time is up, but if anyone has additional questions.
Not seeing any, that concludes this oral argument. Thank you both for well-presented arguments, and this case is now submitted.